Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Nutcracker Syndrome Podcast, episode 7, where we're going to get into the meat of the matter, the kidney auto transplant, which I actually just had as of the recording of this episode 3 months plus a week ago. And as I, fun fact, as I'm actually recording this, I currently have a kidney stone working its way through my ureter. I'm definitely in some discomfort, but this is the reality. And I actually thought a good way to distract myself from this pain is pop a nice little 5 milligram Percocet and record this episode. So I'm not just sitting down thinking about the pain. That's a reality of this. I'll talk about it. I've had kidney stones before. I know what to expect. So some of my anxiety is a little less because I'm like, okay, I know what's going on. I have scans that showed that I had a 3 millimeter kidney stone in my transplanted kidney, which is not surprising. An auto transplant is a very stressful thing for the body to go through. That is what we're dealing with today. But this episode will probably be a little longer than others because there's a lot to pack in here. So the first portion of this will be really just kind of the what and the why and some of the logistical things about an auto transplant. And then I want to get into the kind of play-by-play of what to expect from the procedure itself, what to expect from pre-op, the actual surgery, in my inpatient experience, and then also the follow-up stuff. So I'll make a note in the show notes on if you want to just bypass, like you're like, I know what a kidney auto transplant is, I know why it's an option for Nutcracker. I'll give you the timestamp on where you can go to just skip all this information. For starters, like I said, I had a kidney auto transplant on December 19th of 2024. So I was inpatient during Christmas, and that was actually a very wonderful experience. I don't celebrate the holidays, especially Christmas isn't really my jam. I love New Year's. So that was actually kind of nice to just be able to, it was very quiet on the transplant floor. But for some of you that are like, what the heck is a kidney auto transplant? It is where they relocate your left kidney from where it currently sits from the normal anatomy from where you were born. So on that left side, kind of in that left flank area, they will relocate it. They will transplant it to a new location in your body. Now, there's two different types. There's a traditional kidney auto transplant and there's a hybrid kidney auto transplant. The difference that I have heard, now this is different for every single surgeon. So if a doctor's listening to this and you're like, you got it all wrong, please understand this is what I was told, okay? And I had my kidney auto transplant at UW Health with Dr. Foley and Dr. Phillips in Madison, Wisconsin. So I had a traditional kidney auto transplant, which is where they relocated my left kidney to my right lower abdomen. So just north of my right ovary and just south of my right kidney. I was told that the reason they were doing this is because of my Mayþerner diagnosis. And I asked them further about it because I had a stent placed on August 9th of 2024, so just a couple months prior for the Mayþerner. So I was told by them, and also I've gathered this on the Facebook support group as well, that if you have the Mayþerner anatomy, even if you've been stented or not, or even if you plan to get stented or not, that they will do the traditional just because they don't want to get in the way of potentially intervening with the Mayþerner anatomy. Meaning that if you want to get an intervention done for Mayþerner, they don't want the relocation of that kidney to get in the way. So just put it on the right side. With that, a hybrid auto transplant is where they take your left kidney and they remove it out of the compression area and they lower it down a bit on that left side. So it stays on your left side. And some of the argument for the hybrid, I believe Dr. Zendejas, or at least I've heard it associated with Dr. Zendejas more times than not, is he likes doing the hybrid more often. Because you don't have to cut the ureter from the bladder. So it's like one less step, one less point that could go wrong. Where with the traditional, you have to literally take the entire thing out. You're cutting the ureter from the bladder. You are taking the entire vasculature with you onto the right side. Whereas if you lower it on the left side, there's one less cut I think you have to do, and it doesn't harm the bladder as much. So That is what I was told. I have also gathered that every single surgeon does things a little bit differently. So, like, I remember talking to UC Health with Dr. Pishak and his team whenever they were reopening their Nutcracker program and saying, okay, well, I'm going to go with UW Health just because I can be seen 4 to 5 months sooner and I can't go any longer in this pain. However, if I have a complication, can I be seen by you all as like kind of a follow-up aftercare? And the answer was kind of like, not really. I mean, I would have to go back through the whole process again. Some of that being because, and what I was told is that every surgeon takes a very different approach to surgery. Dr. Pashak uses robotic, Dr. Foley uses a full open abdominal. It's not necessarily like the way Dr. Foley does an auto transplant is the same way Dr. Pashak does, is the same way that Dr. Zendejas does. So it's a little bit of a clusterfuck in that regard. So just know that what I was told about the difference between a traditional and a hybrid and how a surgeon chooses which to do could be completely different than what your surgeon says. Take what I'm telling you and take it as a point of, okay, I need to make sure I go and ask my surgeon about my options. I originally wanted a hybrid auto transplant because I also suffer from endometriosis. Just a year and a half prior, I had my excision for stage four endometriosis, so I was really worried about relocating my kidney to my like lower end of my abdomen because it's kind of in the trauma area, in the war zone, where what happens if it's now more susceptible to get endometriosis lesions on the kidney? So I was wanting a hybrid, but then just kind of how the cards played out, I didn't want to wait any longer to get a procedure, and I just decided, okay, we'll do the traditional relocated to my right lower abdomen. I spoke to a couple other gynecologists whose opinions were that they didn't really actually fear, given that they put the kidney, it's not just free floating. They actually kind of situate it into the internal fossa area, so it's kind of tucked away a little bit. So it is protected. It's not directly in the line of fire. And the hybrid for me, so some of the suggestion was if you have endometriosis, maybe ask about the hybrid auto transplant being a better option for you because it doesn't put it directly into the abdominal area. So that is something just like what is a kidney auto transplant? It's where they are transplanting your own organ. So that's the auto part self. So it's a self transplant. The nice thing about a transplant for us, an auto transplant for us, is we do not have to be on immunosuppressants. So that's a major pro to this particular transplant. It is a major surgery, obviously. But when I was inpatient, I remember they would have like multiple group meetings with the other transplant patients on the floor. And I low key felt like they were leaving me out. I was like, what's going on? Why didn't I get the invite? And as I was walking down there, I heard them say something like, let's talk about the word rejection. And I knew immediately, like, okay, this is why I'm not involved. They're talking about immunosuppressants. And there's a whole nother aspect to that that's really scary. I feel like I'd be a whole nother variable that we don't have to deal with. So just know with this kidney auto transplant, if you're wondering, there are no immunosuppressants involved because it's your own organ that's simply being moved in your body. Where it's being moved is dependent upon you and your surgeon and making the decision that they feel like is best for you. Now, if you, unlike me, I was very like, I'll just take what I can get. Some people might not agree with that, and that's fine. I could have waited. It did not work with the timeline for me and my family, so I just went with the traditional auto transplant. But if you're very much like I want a hybrid and nothing else, there are surgeons out there that can offer you that option. Hopefully, it just depends on your own anatomy. Another thing I'll say is sometimes talking about your anatomy, it could just depend on the square footage that you have available to rehouse your kidney in your lower right abdomen. So I had to do a CTA that was prior to my surgery, very detailed scan where they can go in and see the vasculature and the anatomy of the kidney. And I think from there they just want to make sure that us relocating it to the right side or lowering it down, that there is enough space to do that. Those are other aspects that could come into play. Now, why is a kidney auto transplant an option to treat Nutcracker? The idea is that moving the kidney, which also means moving the vasculature that goes along with it. So the artery, the veins, and the ureter. will be moved along with it, and that will permanently alleviate the compression. So you're not dealing with the aorta and the superior mesenteric artery right there where it causes the compression are no longer a part of the game anymore. So that's where you can move that compression, and it has a what I have gathered to seem to be a higher success rate because you're not playing with the aorta and the superior mesenteric artery. So this also brings me to some other options for addressing nutcracker. So the auto transplant is not the only option. It's the option I chose that I felt like was best for me, but there are other options that people opt into. So while I'm not going to camp out in the different options, there is one thing that I do want to note while I speak about this. So the other options that you have is we separate this into two separate categories. There's the transplant category of options, and there's the vascular surgeon route options. Okay. So the transplant options, one I just told you, the kidney autotransplant. Or the second option under that umbrella is to just donate your left kidney to just get rid of it. That's a whole nother set of tests that you have to undergo to ensure that your kidney is a good option to donate, etc. And then obviously the autoplant transplant is then relocating it in your body. So we've already gone over that. Now, the vascular surgeon route is where they will either do a left renal vein transposition, and there's different types of transpositions, but it's basically them moving that vein out from the compression, either in whatever direction based on your anatomy. The other one is the left renal vein stent, and the stent can also go a couple different ways. There's a stent that can go inside the vein, there's one that can go outside the vein. I personally was not didn't really like either of these options as from my own data gathering. I noticed, like, on the Facebook group, on the Reddit, on the subreddit Nutcracker forum, it seemed like the left renal vein stent did have a higher failure rate, and the left renal vein transposition. So people that went the vascular surgeon route, there did seem to be a higher failure rate, and often those individuals then had to resort to the auto transplant. Or really worst case scenario, something happened with their left renal vein, which compromised it. So the auto transplant wasn't even an option. I've heard that from when I went to UW Health, my in-person appointment. They were actually telling me that. They were saying they have a lot of people that come to them wanting to pursue the auto transplant after a failed left renal vein transposition or stent, but the left renal vein has just been compromised to the point that their only option is donating. That is through the eyes of UW Health. Obviously, go get a second opinion, third opinion if that's you. Maybe there's another surgeon that's like, yeah, your left renal vein's been compromised, but we can see what we can do. So I'm very aware. I'm not going to sit here and be like, oh, UW Health is, because I went with them, everything they says is gold standard. With that, something I do, I'm going to go on a side quest conversation right now, and I'm going to be very passionate about it because, to remind you all, intersected as with my identity being diagnosed with Nutcracker, I am a professor, I am a researcher, I am privy to the language of research, the validity and the reliability needed in research, and something that really grinds my gears is surgeons throwing out success percentages. So, as an example, when I went onto the Facebook support group, there was two very va valuable posts to me. One was that somebody had posted to say, if you had surgery, denote which surgery you had and if it was successful or not. And on those two separate posts, it was pretty wildly seen that an auto transplant was what people had chosen, plus it was the most successful. People who had chosen the left renal vein transposition had noted that maybe a year, two, sometimes three, that there was a failure. This is also, like, auto transplants can also fail, so I don't want to I want to throw that in there. What really grinds my gears is surgeons that'll be like, the left renal vein transposition or stent has an 85% success rate. So they throw out the 85% success rate. Okay, well, show me the data that you're using. Did you follow up with every single patient, even years later, to see if that surgery still worked? Likely not. They probably did a 1 to 3 to 6 month follow-up as per usual and then determined the success rate on those numbers. What's interesting, and I actually know a handful of people, so again, a handful of people, the case number here is small. who had a successful left renal vein transplantation, but it failed years later, which led them to pursue another route, right? They probably found another surgeon that wasn't the same one. So they either pursue an auto transplant or they donate, because the left renal vein transposition or stent failed. So is that patient who had the left renal vein transposition or stent, are they going back to that original surgeon to say, hey, just so you know, this surgery failed? Probably not. I could be wrong about that. If there's somebody out there who has the cojones to do that, to just send an email or be like, hey, this failed, I just want you to know. That's likely not happening because you're just moving forward. So again, I want to provide you with this level of critical awareness. I am usually very sketched out by any doctor who throws around success percentages without any further discussion around the complexity of those numbers, as I believe this is just a stroke of their own ego. Now, this isn't to say anytime a surgeon throws those numbers out, but again, here are the things. So if you're a doctor listening to this, maybe you are. I'm not going to say don't share those percentages, but it is your ethical duty to ensure that you're using those numbers in ethical ways. For example, what variables contribute to that success percentages? What number of patients comprise the number that denotes what that success percentage is? Was it done mostly on males versus females? What are the limitations of the study done that provided you those numbers? Is there a conflict of interest because it's your own research trying to determine if the surgery you are doing is successful, funded by the very university hospital you work for? What measures did you use to assess this data? Are those measures reliable and valid? Can you share the research study with me that is denoting this success percentage? I think you can see where I'm going here. And you might likely be thinking, as a doctor yourself, there's no way I'm sharing all that with my patients. It would take up too much time. And if that's what you're thinking, then maybe don't go around sharing those success percentage numbers with clients as a way to sway them into a surgery that actually doesn't have the percentage of success. And maybe, just maybe, the surgeries that you do conduct do actually fail, but you don't want to swallow that pill, which then can cause harm to others. So that is a side quest conversation that I'm going to go on right now for you all as it pertains to which option you want to choose. I think it is very, like, we need to go in and be our biggest advocate. And sometimes that biggest advocacy is going in with a level of critical awareness. Maybe some, like, I'm privy to this information. I've done research myself. I know the limitations and kind of the loopholes. And people often like to be like, well, the research says, okay, well, send me that research. And if it's just one research study, that's limited alone. Okay. I need to see other modalities. I need to see that it's done on multiple populations. And what's the case size of that? How many people are in that research study? Because you saying it's an 85% success rate, as if it's 85% across every human being in the world that ever needs this number, that's false. So please take what I just gave you to go in, keep that in your back pocket. Hopefully what I just gave you provides you some questions to ask the doctors if they do start throwing out these success rate numbers. I'm not saying that they should not, but there needs to be a deeper conversation than just making you think it's an 85% success rate, meaning that you have an 85% chance of it not failing, and then it does fail, and then you're left being like, how lucky, unlucky am I that I'm a part of the 15%? When in reality, the doctor's not doing their due diligence to actually tell you the complexities of what goes into that percentage and the likelihood that that number is not actually right. So that's a side quest, very important. I'm very passionate about it, and I get very heated when doctors use their whole little white coat and, just tell you these things, and it forces you to make decisions. Like, you go in thinking a certain thing, making a decision that you feel is best for you, and it ends up not going as you planned. So, one other thing I want to talk about before jumping into the like procedure, like step-by-step stuff, and I mentioned this, I believe, in episode two, is the testing to get done prior to your auto transplant. And I would suggest more so getting this testing done prior to your in-person or your initial consult with a nutcracker surgeon to see a rheumatologist to rule in or out whether you have Ehlers-Danlos syndrome. That could be a vital piece of data for the surgeon to know that can inform your recovery time. It can inform how the surgery goes. And then also to rule in or out whether you have MCA, so mast cell activation syndrome, or if you have any allergies to any type of metals or anything like that. The metals is more so for the Mathrone or stent, but those are just nice things to know so you can communicate to the team. To me, it's better that they know than not know and then find out the hard way. So once you get all that testing done prior, maybe right now you're listening to this, go schedule those appointments because as we all know, those appointments might be 3 months out, 4 months out, 6 months out. And if they are, maybe there's somebody else you can find that can get you in a little bit sooner. Once you have all that testing done, plus the testing from your venogram, from your renal hilar block, you gather up all your scans, gather up all this, all the surgeon notes, the doctor's notes, and you send that to your Nutcracker surgeon. So whatever route you want to choose, the auto transplant, donating, left renal vein transposition, or stent, send that to them so that they can have as much and do that as soon as possible. Don't wait for them to tell you to do it. I always would just go ahead and call the front office for whoever and say, what I need to know the details of sending the scans to you. I'm not like this, just so you know, be on the lookout for these scans, et cetera, et cetera. So that's something to kind of the beginning stages of things to think about is so we talked about what the kidney autotransplant is, why it's an option for treating Nutcracker syndrome, the specific options to treat Nutcracker that isn't just the autotransplant, and also going in with a critical awareness to speak to the doctors because if they start throwing out percentage numbers at you, which often can be to stroke their own ego, I get very wary of, is that actually the percentage? Because there's a lot of failed surgeries of people that don't go back and tell that surgeon, hey, this actually failed and I had to opt for something different. And then also testing to get done prior to your auto transplant, preferably before your first initial appointment with a Nutcracker surgeon. So that's kind of part one of this episode. So to transition into part two. So, what to expect from the process? Maybe you have decided that you want to do the auto transplant at any with any surgeon. Again, I went with UW Health with Dr. Foley and Dr. Phillips in Madison, Wisconsin. I had my surgery on December 19th, 2024. So we're about just a week over 3 months post-op. And I am currently battling a bit of a kidney stone working its magic, which has not been fun, but that is one of the complications you can run into post-transplant just because it's very taxing on the body. So, for starters, the whole pre-op experience for me. So, this is going to, I submitted for UW Health, I submitted my self-referral information online. I was contacted pretty quickly, I think within the same week, maybe a day later, actually, or 2 days later, to schedule my phone triage appointment with the transplant coordinator, which was Marcy. I believe, not I believe, I know they've actually added a second transplant coordinator. So that could, you could either get Marcy or the new individual that's in that spot. Had the triage appointment with Marcy, talked for an hour, very detailed about my lived experience. I sent in my scans. My triage appointment on the phone was actually the day before my diagnostic venogram and stent for my Mathurner. So that was on August 8th of 2024. And she took all my triage appointment, all my scans when she got it, and then they meet on Tuesdays to have a larger discussion about their patients. And then it was actually, I was told I'd get a call a week later after that Tuesday appointment to either invite me for an in-person or to decline. It actually, I think, was like 2 to 3 weeks because just some things that can come up is like Dr. Foley, Dr. Phillips can get called and do a transplant and they have to move that Tuesday appointment, Tuesday meeting to the following Tuesday. So that happened to me. It was, kind of excruciating to wait, but I finally got the call that they were inviting me to an in-person. So that was about middle of August. I got the phone call and I wasn't able to schedule that till mid-November. Now I will say I'm an out of state, so I'm in Colorado. Some of that being delayed to about 3 months is because I'm out of state. They did tell me oftentimes when they have cancellations, they'll first call the people that are in state that live closer to fill those just because it's easier logistically to have that done. So it makes sense. So I did have to wait that 3 months to have my in-person. And then once I, in that interim, so between beginning of August to middle of November is when I went and got all the EDS testing, of which I found out I do not have Ehlers-Danlos, MCAs, and allergy testing. So I was able to send them, and I had my renal hyaline block during that time. So I kept sending them scans to be like, add this to my folder, add this to my folder, just so that they had that information. So it was an open line of communication with them. So had my initial consult. It was an entire day where I did lab work right when I showed up. I met with Marcy, the coordinator, then with Dr. Phillips. Spoke to them for about 2 hours. Went and did my CTA, which was about an hour, hour and a half. And then I came back and spoke to the social worker for an hour. I think I had a bit of a break. And then I met with a nutritionist just to measure my frailty, see if I was strong enough for surgery like this. I did a hand grip strength for the nutrition appointment, and a couple other things. They wanted to see if I could walk from point to point and get there in a timely fashion, things like that. I'll go into more detail about that in per like the initial consult. Because now that I'm talking about it, I'm like, actually, there was a lot that went into that day. So I can kind of speak to you all about that. So now we get into pre-op. So I was, after that initial consult, a week later, I got the phone call saying, we believe you're a candidate where we want to invite you for surgery. Thankfully, they had openings the following month. I was told, though, to prepare that it usually is a 3 to 4 month wait from the initial consult. However, because of the holidays and a lot of people don't want to schedule around the holidays, they had a November, December 19th, which worked wonderful for me because my final grades as a professor were due on the 17th. So I was ferociously just grading these papers, getting them submitted literally 2 days before my auto transplant. There was actually a lot of drama involved in that process. A lot of students decided they wanted to cheat on their papers during that time. I don't know if it was because they were taking advantage of me, being sick, thinking I wouldn't see it, but that was a whole nother just headache prior to my transplant. So I arrive in Madison and I had a pre-op appointment. So usually it's either 24 hours or 48 hours prior. You'll come in and do blood work, kind of that pre-screening stuff. I think I had to do, was it an X-ray? I think, yeah, I had to get an X-ray done. There were some other things you had to do. So it was like two separate meetings, two separate appointments prior to coming for surgery. And then surgery, I had to be there, I think it was like 5 a.m., 6 a.m. To get prepped. So the pre-op, very similar to other surgeries. If you've had them, they bring you back, they put an IV in, they go over your list of medication and allergies, and then you wait for all the docs to start shuttling in. So the first doctor that came in for me was anesthesia. And I'd actually spoken on the phone the day prior to anesthesia, just to kind of let them know my prior experience with anesthesia. I let them know that I often wake up with an extremely low blood pressure. So that was something that was good for them to know. But overall, the anesthesia meeting was very great convo. They sat down and provided me with my options for post-op pain. And I went in thinking that they were going to use one modality for pain management, which I don't know, I forget the specific name, but it's where they do a nerve block on where your transplanted kidney is at, which would deliver a localized anesthetic to that area. However, since I had taken a Percocet within a 48-hour window, I think it's like between 48 hours to a week prior to surgery, they actually offered me another option, which was to do an epidural. They highly suggested this option for me, given that I had used the opioid before surgery. Given that that opioid might have decreased the efficacy of the other pain management, so the nerve block they were wanting to do. So I chose to do the epidural route. They inserted it at the T8, T9 junction, which numbed me from my sternum to my pubic bone. And personally, I love this option. It was not without its complications, so I'll go into that in a minute. So while, again, I had complications with the epidural itself. So they had to turn the numbing medication off for a couple of days for my blood pressure to stabilize. But I do felt it helped me manage my pain super well, because once they took the epidural out on day 5, I was definitely able to see the level of heavy lifting the epidural was doing on numbing that area, so I wasn't experiencing the pain. My pain did increase after they took the epidural out, but I did have access to my pain pump every 15 minutes, which was of the pain pump was of Dilaudid. But the goal ultimately for everybody is to get off all IV pain meds and onto oral pain med regimen. So the epidural itself, while they told me the rationale for offering me this option, I'm not 100% sure if all hospitals work this way or anesthesia teams. So this is something to discuss with your surgery team to see if it's a good option for you. As I stated, I did have some complications with it. A little bit more detail there. They inserted the epidural right before surgery. When I woke up, I was dancing on a pretty thin line between unconscious and conscious for about 2 hours, which was probably the scariest thing for me during this entire process. The anesthesia team was a little perplexed. They later told me, I mean, again, this was me remembering this kind of in and out of consciousness. They told me the epidural, which was administering a numbing medication to my abdomen, was actually causing my blood pressure to stay dangerously low. So they stopped that medication until I was able to show stable blood pressure numbers, and also be able to transition from lying down to standing up without any issues. This meant that I was without the epidural medication, the numbing medication, for a total of 2 days. And then once my blood pressure stabilized, we were able to get the full benefit of the epidural, which was great. So I share this to say it might sound nice to have your entire abdomen numb for a portion of your inpatient stay. And there are risks with choosing an epidural if you are offered this option. One other thing I do want to note, I had two things connected to my epidural. There was a numbing medication itself. The name of the medication starts with an R. I'm blanking on it, which is what we commonly know an epidural to be. But they also had Dilaudid hooked into the epidural, which meant that every time I'd get a hit of the numbing medication, I also got a hit of localized Dilaudid, which means I had pain medication flowing directly to the site, so directly to that kind of sternum to pubic bone. On top of the localized pain management being funneled through my epidural unit, I was also hooked to a pain pump of Dilaudid, which I was allowed to push every 15 minutes. So this is a systemic form of Dilaudid, which means my entire body felt the effects of it. I was definitely flying high for a while on this drug, as it's a necessary evil. I was having a lot of lucid dreams. I do remember waking up once, kind of not knowing where I was. That was kind of weird. That lasted like 15 seconds. But please report those things to your anesthesia team, as that's good for them to know. If you feel uncomfortable, they might have something else that they can switch you to. Another point I wanted to make is that the Dilaudid that I was on, obviously necessary evil, but the detox coming off that was not very fun. My worst symptom was just the horrible night sweats that I have. So if some of you are worried about the Dilaudid, obviously you can talk to the pain management team about this to determine what's the best pain management route for you. For me, I wasn't too worried about it. I don't have much adverse experiences with pain meds, but just know that that's something to advocate for. My anesthesia team, pain management team, was great. They very much reminded me constantly that I was in the driver's seat. What could they do to help me? So, just know that they're there to help you. They don't want to give you a drug that you don't like. So that is the kind of anesthesia pre-op aspect of this. The surgery itself was my paperwork that I got. They let me know it'd be anywhere from 4 to 7 hours. Mine was a little over 4 with no complications in surgery, which was great. And then the only complication I had was waking up, like I mentioned, due to my epidural, due to the numbing medication. But once I got inpatient, that first 2 days is very, I was, you know, they had me hooked to a catheter, so I wasn't like getting out of bed to go pee. That was actually nice. There are days kind of on those lazy days you wish you had a catheter so you didn't even have to get up to go pee. So the first 2 days I wasn't really getting up that much. I also was still trying to stabilize my blood pressure during that time, and I was also on oxygen because anytime I would fall asleep, my oxygen would tank. So those first 2 days are very critical. So I wasn't able to walk for the first time until 2 days post-op, once I was able to get my blood pressure stabilized, my oxygen stable, and was able to use the epidural, the numbing medication, properly, and it wasn't causing me any adverse symptoms. Something I want to say, I was told at UW Health my inpatient stay would be anywhere between 5 to 10 days, and they were obviously checking in on this daily. to see like, okay, when should we discharge this individuals? For some surgeons though, and I'll use Dr. Zendejas in Salt Lake City as an example here. I have heard reports of them not keeping patients as long after surgery. They'll discharge them on day 2, 3 post-op, which personally I would have hated. And I think that would have caused me more mental harm as well, because those 9 days that I was inpatient, those first 2 days to me were almost like we couldn't really start the countdown until day 3, because again, I had those complications with my blood pressure. So let's say I was there for, 7 to 9 days. I needed those 7 to 9 days, just for me to feel more confident, being discharged, being at home, having, Kyle, my boyfriend, help me out. Because those first couple of days, I would say day 1 to 4, very vital, very fragile, very vulnerable. I had no other complications. There was a couple like kind of weird things that popped up here and there, but nothing major. But it was nice to have that nurse call button for the times that those kind of weird things did pop up. Because the first, again, 4 or 5 days, you're pretty fragile. So that's something to take into consideration if you're talking to a transplant team, asking them about that inpatient stay. I would be a little weary. This is from my lived experience. If they tell you they're going to discharge you day 2, day 3, I don't know. Is this is a transplant surgery? This is pretty major. So discharging you that quickly to me is just a little too. I think they're asking a lot of the patient to go home and deal with that level of pain without having access to a nurse kind of right there. With that, I had my surgery over Christmas, so that could have been one of the variables at play. I'm not sure how much it was Christmas, so there wasn't as many transplants happening. I don't know if that's how it works. So they weren't necessarily pushing me out of the inpatient room, given that maybe there weren't as many transplant patients coming through. Again, I'm not sure if that's how it works. So if I wanted to stick around a little longer than needed, I'm sure that, I think if I would have just been like, no, I want another day. And they're like, no, I think they would have obviously pushed me out and been like, no, you have to go. But they kept reassuring me I was in the driver's seat, which was really great. So keep that in mind as far as your inpatient stay goes. Something to ask your surgeon, what is the typical inpatient stay like? Are you going to try to push me out day 2, say 3, things of that nature. Recovery time, I was off all my hardcore pain medication, so I wasn't taking any Percocet or oral pain meds other than like Tylenol at around 2.5 weeks post-op. I was also off all my anti-anxiety meds. And I remember going into my 3-week post-op appointment feeling really great. The travel, we were released to travel back to Colorado. That was a bit for my body. While I did feel great on the travel, once I got back to Colorado, my kidney started acting up. So it was just hurting pretty badly. There weren't any other issues that would warrant a kidney infection. So my urinalysis came back fine. So there were some ups and downs at that 1 month mark. I mean, even now, 3 months post-op, like I just said, I've been dealing with kind of this kidney stone pain. Today I feel a little bit better, thankfully. But those are things just, on that journey, it's not this straight trajectory. There's going to be some ups and downs to remember. But again, after about 48 hours, usually I was about back to normal. So it's a roller coaster. Just ride it out. You have people that you can call. For me, I call my primary, see if I can get into them. I'll call the transplant team to say, hey, is this normal? So that's kind of the recovery timeline. The first month is when I was told I needed to stay in Madison for about 3 weeks to a month, just for that kind of immediate care, in case something did go south. I was then discharged at the 3 week mark to come back to Colorado. And then my next a milestone is the 3 month mark. I just had that a week and a half ago, where I got cleared to be able to move to 30 pounds weightlifting restrictions, and I could do whatever activities I wanted, barring that I just check in with my body and make sure I'm not doing too much. But the follow-up appointments are that kind of 1, 3, 6, 12 month marker. One thing to note is that I had my surgery in Madison at UW Health. I just had my 3 month follow-up with them, and I was also told that that's kind of where our relationship stops. Obviously, I can call them if I have any complications. They can help me figure some stuff out, but I won't have any formal meetings with them, appointments with them moving forward, because that's kind of the law that, like, if you have out-of-patient care, insurance won't continue. Like, you'll just get 1 3-month follow-up, and then after that, they kind of hand you back to your medical team that's in your state. So tell your medical team that prior. A lot of us don't have the option to do an in-state auto transplant. So talk to your medical team, your primary care surgeon, your primary care surgeon, your primary care doctor about that follow-up at the 6 month, the 12 month mark. The transplant team will speak to your primary care team about that to kind of prep them, but that was something I wasn't expecting. I didn't realize like at the 3 month mark. I was thinking my 6 month appointment would also be with UW Health and my 12 month would also be with them. But they just want to get the blood work done during the 6 and 12. They'll get those notes back to them, which is fine. So if there is anything there, we could likely work through that. But just keep that in mind so it doesn't come out of left field for you. There was a couple things that I wasn't expecting to happen with the surgery that I want to talk about here. So the first one is I've heard about people getting transplant surgeries, traditional transplants, where they get somebody else's kidney and they wake up and their taste buds are different. Maybe they all of a sudden love sports and they hated them before. Those type of weird things. I wasn't expecting that to happen to me. So I've actually lost my love for some foods that I previously enjoyed. Like fish now is disgusting to me. And I primarily ate fish prior to the surgery, which is such a sad, sad loss. And it could come back. We'll see. Cilantro, I used to love prior. And now I'm in the camp of people where it tastes like soap. And that really sucks. Again, some of this could change. But what I learned is that. It's more so an anesthesia thing. So when you have a surgery and you're under anesthesia for a really long time, it can change your taste buds. So that might not happen to everybody, but it's definitely happened to me. So keep that in mind. Another thing is when I traveled back to Colorado from Madison, the altitude did a number on my kidney. I was not thinking about this, and I also didn't have anybody tell me to think about this. While we can't really know for certain if it's a direct correlation between the altitude and my kidney hurting, it definitely it's what we boiled it down to. So it could have been obviously the long drive. So I think it was like an 18-hour drive from us from Madison back to Colorado. That could have jostled some things around, obviously. But I just want to note my experience with altitude change because we were going from like sea level institution to a 65 107K feet of elevation that we're living in. So adjustments could happen, right? Oxygen is different. Additionally, if you're traveling, for example, like from Colorado, you're traveling to Colorado from somewhere that's at sea level, it could impact your body's ability to recover. So it's kind of both ways. You have the surgery at sea level, you come back to recover at altitude, or you have the surgery at altitude, go back to sea level. That could change some things. So the high altitudes, just to give you some more specific, can cause a low oxygen saturation or even desaturation of the individual's blood. So it's an atmospheric pressure thing at high altitude. So oxygen saturation levels are really about the extent the hemoglobin is bound or saturated to the oxygen. So if it's harder to get oxygen, so if you're having surgery in Colorado, for example, that could affect. I might even assume that maybe you need to use the oxygen in your nose a little bit more than when you're at sea level or vice versa. So just something to discuss with your medical team, keep in the back of your mind about traveling to and from somewhere with altitude. One other thing that came up for me as I was chatting about is something else I wasn't expecting, and this is kind of funny after the fact, but in the moment it was not. It was maybe day four, day five. Actually, I think it was day three, day four. I all of a sudden started getting my left labia right labia started swelling like crazy. And that ended up being they said that this at first they were like, this isn't necessarily normal. But they I finally the charge nurse came in and said they had one other kidney auto transplant patient that had that happen before. And they believe it was just the kidney, all the swelling that had happened. All the swelling that had happened, that it had just basically with the kidney auto transplant, You're moving your kidney around, so the filtration and stuff. So I gained about, gosh, it was like 25 pounds in 48 hours. That was also something I wasn't expecting. So that fluid, or maybe just the kidney itself was swelling. We're not 100% sure. I went and had a kidney ultrasound done. Everything came back fine. I did have some fluid retention. It looked like it was almost like a liquefied hematoma that was around my kidney. That could have been pressing on the left ovarian kind of vein in that area. That could have caused the enlarged labia to swell. So I just remember texting Kyle and being like, he's like, how's it going? And I was like, well, my right labia looks like a nutsack. So that was the best way of putting it. And I was able to, we just gave it, we monitor it. We just gave it a couple of days and it started to go down, which was nice that it did that. So just know that was two things that I also wasn't expecting was the weight gain between the first 48 hours. I mean, I looked like an absolute cylinder of a woman, and that did go away with time. The pressure from gaining that much weight, it was fluid retention from all the water that they're pumping in you during surgery, and then also postoperatively, they can give you something to, I forget the name of the drug, but they gave it to me in IV form, and it helped me to just pee out that liquid, so that was nice. With that being said, if they do give you that drug to pee out all that kind of water weight that you have, I was going in thinking, I didn't make the connection that that was happening. So I was getting like 900 milliliter pees, thinking that was normal. So when I went home post-op, I brought one of the little pee hats with me, and I was only getting, 300, 400, 500 milliliters of pee. And I was like, oh no, I'm getting a reduction of pee. When I called and asked about it, they were like, oh yeah, well, we had remember you were peeing out all of that liquid, that fluid retention that you had, which is why the increase. So keep that in mind too. Don't freak out if you have a reduction in urine output. They obviously they'll tell you the common kind of framework. I think it was like, I forget the parameters, but like this is a normal production of urine during a day. So if you're hitting those numbers, that's what matters. So the fluid retention was there. I wasn't expecting that. I also was not expecting for my right labia to swell like it did, which was obviously a little concerning because my head was like, is this going to stay permanently? This is great that I'm like correcting my nutcracker syndrome, but is this going to harm, like, am I going to be ra going around with a right nutsack for the rest of my life? Kyle, what's kind of funny about this whole story is that he is a very woozy guy. He doesn't like blood. He's not really great in the medical space. And as far as that stuff goes, he's like, I don't want to see anything oozing. I don't want to see blood. So I text him about my right labia swelling, and he comes in every day he visited me. And he comes in and is like, I'm thinking, oh, I'm just gonna tell him about it. He's not gonna wanna see it. But he comes in immediately and is like, let me see this right labia. And I showed it and he's like, oh, that's not that bad. Like, I think in his head, it was like so much worse, which was just funny. I was like, oh, you're not woozy about this. That is really funny. But don't freak out if that happens to you. I have heard from other like charge nurses, people that had been around the space a little longer, that they have had patients that that has happened to. It's not the most common, but it's not necessarily something that they're like, oh, this is a bad thing, but it is something to report if you see it. I saw it for the first time when I went pee, and I was like, oh, I'm swelling really bad down there. So keep that in mind. For this episode, so that concludes me chatting about just the kidney auto transplant, some of the previous things, what it is, why it's an option for Nutcracker, and also talk about the other options. Going on my little side quest on surgeons that use success percentages with you and don't ethically talk about the other parameters there. So keep that in mind as you speak to those surgeons. Testing to get done prior as well. So don't forget about that. Go ahead and schedule that now. If not yesterday, it should have been scheduled, as we all know. And then what to expect from the process. I'm hoping that I hit on as many things that maybe you had questions about. These are things that I spoke when I was making my outline as far as the bullet points I want to talk about. These were the most asked questions. It does not mean that I answered your questions. So if you do have any more, please drop those in the comments. You could also go to the Facebook. I want to continue to encouraging you going to the Nutcracker Facebook support group, going to the subreddit, the Nutcracker Syndrome subreddit, and ask your questions there. People are very willing to help out as much as they can. But before you go, as always on these episodes, I just want to invite you to wherever you're at, take that deep breath in through your nose and then slowly exhale. Grounding yourself more into this moment. And then another deep inhale through your nose. And then slowly exhale. And then keep with that flow at your own pace as you transition into listening to either the next episode or go about your day. And whatever is next for you, just take a second again, as always, to actively, explicitly send gratitude for yourself, for showing up for yourself. Even if it's just listening to this podcast to gather more data from my lived experience, that is you advocating. That is you showing up. Okay? Be proud of yourself. I am proud of you on this journey, wherever you are at. So just keep going.